Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. My guest on this episode of the Grant Williams podcast is my great friend David Hay, the co-CIO of Evergreen Gavkell in Bellevue, Washington, and now the publisher of the excellent Haymaker on Substack. Dave and I have known each other for almost 15 years now, I think, and I've found him to be one of the most thoughtful, pragmatic, and insightful managers that I've had the good fortune to encounter over that entire period. And every chance I get to talk with Dave is something I just relish. And so as he launched the Haymaker, it felt like the perfect opportunity to pick his brain about how he sees a very different investment environment to the one we've been trying to navigate for the last couple of decades. As always, I went away from our conversation with both answers and a ton of questions. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with David Hay. Dave, mate, it's so good to see you and a real pleasure to have you join me on the podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great, Grant, but I'm not as good as you because you're in all heaven right now. And I'm incredibly jealous. I would love to be there with you.
I am absolutely in golf heaven. Scotland is the place to be if you're a golfer. As you know, it's fantastic, especially this time of the year. And even though the weather is kind of average, it beats the kind of weather you get most other places. So I'll take it. Mate, there is so much to talk about. You know, you and I talk periodically and we kind of compare notes and we sit there, both of us scratching our heads. And we've been joined in recent weeks by a series of kind of high profile investors. We've seen Michael Burry short the hell out of the S&P and the QQQs, which got a lot of headlines. And one of my investment heroes, I know someone you hold in great stead, Seth Klarman, also called this one of the most confusing times he's seen in his career. You know, I know you pay attention to just about everything. And I know you sit for hours thinking about it all, trying to work it out. Give me a sense of the tug of war in your head, because I know there's one going on there about the data and the likely reality that lies underneath it, because we can kick this around all night. You know, there's so many different parts this we can pull apart.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm glad you brought up the Klarman quote, because I think that sums it up. And it kind of reminds me of what Edward R. Murrow, the famous journalist, said decades ago, that anybody who isn't confused doesn't understand the situation.
Right.
And I think that's very applicable to today. But I think part of the problem is that, especially for, you know, the newer people in our business, and by new, I mean, you know, the last 15 years, they've really never seen the lead up to a real recession. And you can't count COVID, though I think we were actually going into one, but it just, you know, that accelerated everything. And so it, you know, what would normally happen in a year happened in a month. And you didn't have the kinds of situation we have right now, the type of situation where it's really kind of a slow motion evolution into recession. And I think the slowness of it, at least in terms of the official data, is what's throwing a lot of people. But not that different, really, than it was back in 06, 07, which I, you know, vividly remember. And, you know, you had the S&P that made a new all-time high in October of 2007. And then the official arbiter of recessions, the NBER, went back and said that we were actually in recession in December of 07. And yet things seemed fine at that time. The economy was actually humming along, apparently. So that's one of the problems with when you're looking at contemporaneous data, is that it can often be misleading, and it's so often revised downward. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing. In fact, today we're talking on a day when this big downward revisions to payrolls has happened. That's even some of the people that tend to have a pretty optimistic take on the economy are surprised by that, but they shouldn't be. And in fact, even before this, one of the points that I made in a podcast yesterday is that non-farm payrolls have been revised downward already for six consecutive months. And the other thing that I, you know, when people say, you know, you've been talking about recession for a while, but we have a profits recession already on our hands. We've got an industrial transportation recession on our hands. We've got a government tax revenue recession on our hands. And we've got a GDI, as in gross domestic income, recession on our hands. You know, that's quite a bit of data and you know, trends that are going against the consensus view, because as you know, the consensus is quite convinced that we're not going to have a recession anytime soon. They're also convinced that the inflation numbers are going to continue to be very soft and encouraging and downward trending. And I think both of those are, you know, at risk. But I especially believe that, unlike the consensus, that the odds of a recession, instead of going down every day, are actually going up every day.
Yeah, well, let's talk about some of the signposts for that, because I'm in your camp for sure. And really, if you just think about what's going on, forget the data, you just look around you at the world and look around at the stresses and the strains that you're seeing, particularly in this rate environment where, if nothing else mattered, the fact that so many mortgage payments are increasing, the fact that so many car payments are increasing, these are kind of the basics that people need. Food, shelter, and energy are through the roof. It just doesn't seem to make sense at face value that the economy will be humming along just fine. But talk about some of the signs you've seen in the data that suggest that a recession is more likely than not.
Well, I think it really boils down to which data set you're looking at. Because if you look at the coincident data, it still looks pretty good. But again, that's typical. Where you really see a problem in the data is all the leading indicators. I mean, the leading economic indicators are down 16 straight months. Why are they called leading economic indicators? Because they lead. And I think that should be worthy of intense focus. I think the yield curve, and I know a lot of people are blowing off the yield curve, as they always do. I mean, that's another thing that I remember vividly from 06, 07, is don't worry about the inverted yield curve because it's happening at what was perceived to be a low level of interest rates. But the reality is its track record is flawless, at least when it's deeply inverted, and it's been inverted for a considerable period of time, which is clearly the case this time. And there's just so many data points that only playing out the way they're playing out right now, right on the cusp of a recession. I think it's either heroic or reckless or naive to believe that this time is going to be different in that regard. Is, you know, the stimulus is still in the system. I mean, I think that's what's delayed it, is that all that fake money that was created when we were basically doing MMT during the lockdowns, that money did stay in the system and has been, you know, I think that's been definitely supporting economic activity at a time when it perhaps should have normally tipped into recession.
But we've seen data points, we've seen some really shaky company reporting in the last couple of weeks from the likes of Walmart, from the likes of FedEx, UPS, you know, all these kind of bellwethers of the economy. And it's just getting ignored by people. You know, people are just happy to kind of make excuses for that as though it doesn't really matter. I'm just bewildered by that, because these are the foundational companies that really give you a sense of the underlying economy. Why do you think people are so keen to just ignore them?
Well, I think, first of all, I want to just to reiterate what you said. You mentioned FedEx and UPS, and I think those two are particularly important to look at. And what I think, I don't really hear anybody talking about, but it's just a fact, is that their revenues are falling for the first time since the Great Recession. That should be an eye-opener, but it's not. And of course, that's not even adjusting for inflation, because if you looked at real revenues, it would be even worse. And that's one of the gripes I have, is when you look at some of these numbers that, you know, look superficially robust, like Walmart, you know, that was a little bit better. It was like 6%, but you know, how much of that's just inflation? And then you look at companies like Lowe's, which, you know, is out today with some pretty cautionary comments. And, you know, you mentioned Walmart, and, you know, while that number looked okay, they basically said the consumer is not doing well. The consumer's pressured, and they're trading down from higher priced goods to lower priced goods, which is something that we're hearing pretty repeatedly. And even some people are talking about the rich recession, and that the high end is struggling quite a bit right now, which some of the luxury branded makers are actually, you know, they're reporting that as well. And even in the United States. And then of course you've got the Chinese economy, which is a mess. And the latest data out of Europe was soft, and I guess it just depends on where you want to look. But as we know, Wall Street has such a bullish bias. It just so consistently wants to put a positive spin on things. And I mean, today, which there is a little bit of a flurry of weak economic data between the ISM numbers, the services number, which was softer than expected, and the job revisions that we talked about, the market's up. And, you know, you can say, well, that's because interest rates are down. And so that's a really fascinating thing to talk about, because I think that's what really could be very different this time. Because normally, when you go into a recession, the long-term treasury rates come down. But as you're aware, and I know you track Luke Groman, and he's done tremendous amounts of brilliant work on this topic, we could be in a situation where interest rates actually, at least at the long end of the treasury curve, rise in a recession. And what he's been citing, as I have been citing, is, you know, what could cause that would be just an onslaught of new supply. And as you're aware, the Treasury recently, at the same time that Fitch downgraded the U.S., the Treasury increased its issuance for the second half of the year to $1.85 trillion, you know, a truly staggering amount of money in 6 months. And what's amazing is it's happening at a time when unemployment is 3.5%, supposedly. And I say supposedly because I think there are real questions. Is unemployment really that low for some of the reasons we talked about? But that would be really a shocker if we did see the Treasury rates go up at a time of weakening economic activity. And I think that's a distinct possibility. I mean, you just have to wonder, well, where will that federal deficit go in the next recession, given how high it is? I mean, it's basically at a wartime level, you know, 8% type of deficit of GDP. That's just, it's totally unprecedented outside of World War II.
Well, I'm glad you brought up that $1.85 trillion of new issuance in the second half this year, because, you know, when I saw that number, I was absolutely astounded that it really barely seemed to get much of a mention. You know, if you were looking in places that really focus on this stuff, it was certainly causing some raised eyebrows. But mainstream media, most of the news outlets, it just, the number came and went, and it didn't really seem to merit much commentary. But talk a little bit about why that number is so important and what that issuance is liable to do to markets, because you can't do that without the effect being felt elsewhere. And the places that effect's going to be felt is really not going to be helpful to any of this.
Right. I mean, you were already talking about some of these interest rate hits that consumers are facing because of the rates where they are already. And yet that hasn't fully hit yet, because there is definitely a lag in terms of when the rates go up substantially before it starts hitting things like you mentioned, auto payments. Now, America's lucky because for the most part, our mortgage payments are fixed, whereas in other countries, it's hitting much harder and faster, but it's still going to hit here. And David Rosenberg has made the point that you're going to have something like half of all U.S. public and private debt resetting at 2 to 4%, 200 to 400 basis points higher over the next 2 years. So it's coming. And the other thing that's hitting a lot of people that gets very little press are these insurance rates. But I think is news of, you know, some of these, like the fires and the tragic fires on Maui, but also some of the other, you know, floods and the hurricane that hit Southern California here lately, that, you know, insurance rates for a lot of people are a big deal, and they are going up tremendously. So I see this squeeze that is just getting worse and worse. And yet you're right, that it is remarkable how the mainstream financial media overlooks these really major developments and just assumes that this is going to be kind of the normal situation. And I think even when it comes to, if you do believe in a recession, it's not going to be a normal recession, unfortunately, because if you do get rising long-term interest rates in a recessionary environment, you know, that's going to be a big problem. But the other thing I think that's interesting that I don't think anybody's really talked about is we don't even hear much about the double tightening. And that's the idea that the Fed has not only raised interest rates drastically, but it's also shrinking its balance sheet. So this gets back to your question about the $1.85 billion of issuance. I mean, where it's really a train wreck is when you realize the Fed is back to doing quantitative tightening. So they're shrinking their balance sheet at about a $1 trillion annual rate. So you've lost your biggest buyer. He's the biggest buyer, now the biggest seller. You've got foreign central banks, which for the most part are disposing of treasuries, not accumulating treasuries. You've got the banks, which are obviously, you know, their big problem was having too much, you know, too many treasuries and too long-term treasuries. So it's, you add all this up, and I just don't see how you don't have what I've been calling the 4F scenario, which is the federal fiscal funding fiasco in the second half of the year. And yet the market's, you know, trading very close to all-time highs, which to me is just tremendous complacency. And I think that could be one of the biggest bubbles right now, a bubble in complacency. But I should finish this idea of what is the triple tightening? Because this is a bit more esoteric and a little bit more maverick, but it actually relates to Lacey Hunt. And one of the points that he's made, which is that this big deficit spending, which is perceived to be stimulative, is actually contractionary. Admittedly, on a near-term basis, it does tend to, you know, accelerate economic activity when the government, you know, borrows a ton of money and spends a ton of money, which it's doing. But if you look longer term, and here's the time frame that he typically uses, about 6 quarters. So after about 6 quarters, what was, you know, kind of this sugar high to the economy actually turns out to be a drag. And I think the proof of that is to look at the amount of debt that the federal government has added over the last 23 years, basically, you know, in this century slash millennium. And all that debt has actually led to the weakest growth on record. So it's pretty clear that there is this negative multiplier effect. And I just don't think that gets really any attention. So if you have this drag from higher interest rates, the headwinds from the Fed's balance sheet shrinkage, and then also the drawdown, the dead weight pull from these exploding deficits, you know, once they've worked their way through the system, I mean, it makes this idea of a lagged into a very uncomfortable situation even more terrifying, frankly.
Well, let's talk about the other side of this argument. Let's play devil's advocate. I still can't quite get over this idea that people are saying there could be a no landing scenario. I just love this idea. People come up with these crazy little kitschy phrases and they catch on. But let's push that aside for now. Let's talk about a soft landing. Let's talk about the argument for that. You know, strong retail sales, rising GDP expectations. Talk me through that side of the ledger and how you see those arguments.
Well, they're true if you accept the government statistics at face value, which I don't quite. But I do want to give a shout out to my friend Vincent Delaware, because he's been really on this theme correctly all year and even last year, saying, not so fast. I don't think we're going to get a recession. And his logic was because of the unprecedented amount of stimulus that was still left in the system. He also believes we've got this gig economy where a lot of jobs aren't really being officially picked up on. And I think he could argue, well, that's because, you know, people have to have a second job because their first job doesn't pay them enough to actually, you know, get by. And that is one of the interesting things about the economic statistics, the unemployment statistics lately, is that actually full-time jobs have been declining and part-time jobs have been increasing. But yeah, I think just in general, that's kind of the winning argument for why this recession has been delayed, is that there's just been so dang much money in the system. But pretty much every study I look at indicates that it's now running down, or it's very close to being exhausted. So we're going to lose that tailwind, you know, pretty soon. And then all these other headwinds that we've discussed, I think, are really going to start to intensify. So I think you have to concede that the people like Vincent have been, you know, pretty spot on. I know Greg Jensen, who you interviewed, and I love your interviews that you did with him. He was very concerned about the economy last summer, and as it turns out, he was a little premature. But I think that's been one of the points that he's conceded. It's been because of this. He just underestimated the positive impact on the economy from all the government spending. But again, it gets back to, you know, we're so familiar with the long and variable lags from monetary policy, we don't think of it the way that Lacey Hunt describes it with fiscal. And if it's really true, and again, I think you look at the data and the logic of, you know, which we didn't really get into a moment ago, is that why is all this tsunami of federal spending actually not beneficial and a liability to economic growth? And I think it comes down to the fact that it tends to be so misallocated. That you're taking money from the private sector, giving it to the public sector, which does a lot of really stupid things with the money. And I think that, you know, looking at this Inflation Reduction Act, as noble as the aspirations are, the amount of money that has already been wasted with these, you know, various green energy companies that have failed. And I think, frankly, that the cost of that, the expense of that, is up ahead of us. The really big bill to come due lies ahead. I think it's really hard to dismiss that. I think he could argue about the timing, and, you know, maybe he's not right about six quarters, but I put it all together, and I think that there's just a tremendous amount of brag coming our way.
But we touched on Walmart earlier on and the comments from the CEO in the conference call, and yet everybody's pointing to the consumer being robust and retail sales being really, really strong. How do you kind of square that circle? Because there are two completely divergent narratives being laid out here, one by the data and one by the business that these companies are seeing at ground level. At what point does that resolve itself, do you think?
Well, I would say soon, but I think one of the contributing factors could be autos, because autos obviously have a huge impact on the economy. And I think this was actually from Lacey Hunt as well, that because we know the auto inventories got drawn way down. And so there was a surge in auto production in the first half of the year. And apparently that was a significant contributor to GDP. But now those inventories have been built up and you're not seeing that, you know, that kind of frenzy to buy new and used cars that you were, you know, certainly in 2021. So that particular temporary boost is probably largely played out. At least that would be my suspicion. But I do think that there's just a fair amount of mismeasurement occurring by the government statisticians. But, you know, that's typical. That's really what happens as you transition from expansion into contraction, is that you get this, you know, kind of, it's just like the changing of the tides, and you get to kind of that slack tide point. And I think that's where we're at right now. So, you know, maybe that's why we really will see a soft landing, but that soft landing is just a temporary respite before we really get hit by the hurricane. And speaking of the hurricane, of course, that's what we're moving into for the stock market. This is the classic hurricane season coming upon us, and the market is acting a little squishy right now. So that's the other part of it, is that when you talk to people that are in particularly the kind of higher end business lines, and if the stock market's strong, their business is pretty good. If the stock market falls out of bed, then all of a sudden people, you know, especially for things like, let's say, flying private, which is one of the people I'm referring to, then all of a sudden that changes overnight. So it's, and frankly, that was one reason why I thought we would see a full-blown official recession a little bit earlier, is because there was obviously a tremendous amount of wealth destruction last year that generally impacts consumer spending fairly quickly. But yeah, maybe the difference is because there was just so much free government money still coursing through the veins of the economy.
I mean, you switch us to the stock market, which is perfect. But the last kind of 6 months, we've seen extraordinary strength in the stock market. It's really caught me by surprise. But when you look at that, you look at the performance of, you know, what's now become known as the Magnificent Seven. We have to have an acronym or a cute name somewhere. It's not exactly hiding the poor performance of the market underneath. This is the bit that I kind of struggle with. It's not as though it's easy to point to the market and say the market is strong. The market clearly isn't strong. It's a very, very narrow group of stocks that are doing all the heavy lifting. Give us your assessment of the stock market and where the weakness in that potentially lies.
Well, of course, you're exactly right. I mean, there's just no dispute about it. I was just looking at the NYSE composite, which is a much broader index than the S&P 500, much less influenced by the Mag 7. And it's only up through yesterday, 3.3% before dividends. So, you know, that's not anything special, especially after the shellacking it took last year. So I wrote in, I think it was mid-June, I think it was called, one of our newsletters called How Narrow Was My Rally? And the logic was, because I was of the same belief, that it was just a matter of time before the market cracked, because you can't have that narrow leadership. That's just not healthy. But I took the counterpoint, as you said earlier, devil's advocate. And so what if it's a matter of the laggards catching up to the leaders? And actually, for a lot of the summer, that did happen. We did get a nice kind of broadening of the rally. And if that continues, then maybe make the case that we are in a new bull market. I have my doubts that that's likely to continue, but it's been a nice snapback. And, you know, things like energy, which was, of course, a big laggard through most of the first half of the year. So I don't know. I have a hard time believing that even the Magnificent Seven, especially with the valuation they've got right now, where you've got Apple at a $3 trillion market cap, which I believe is bigger than the entire German stock market, how people are going to make much money from that. Apple's sales have been very impressive. Actually, they've been contracting as well. And yet you've got this, you know, 30 times earnings. I can remember during the glory days of Apple, when you really wanted to own it, it would trade at 10 to 15 times earnings. And it was actually a value stock for a lot of, and I'm talking about the last 10 years. I'm not talking about 20 years ago before they got all the great new iPads and iPhones and so forth. So it's very odd, but there's just no question that that trade is incredibly crowded. And I actually stuck my neck out back in late July in my newsletter and said I thought that we were on the cusp of a correction in the QQQ. And that indeed has happened. Now, is it, you know, is this just a temporary pause? Nobody really knows. But I do think that the risk of substantially higher interest rates from here is a major problem. And I did send you the chart of the 10-year treasury looking back 30 years. I mean, it's clearly broken a 30-year downtrend in yield. So that bull market, which started actually in the early 80s, looks to be over. And frankly, for most of the last 40 years, I've been a bond bull. At least I was a bond bull up until the summer of 2020. When we got the 10-year yield down to 55 basis points, and yet inflation was starting to accelerate. We were doing MMT, modern monetary theory. Now, that's nuts. We're going to get inflation, and these bonds are going to get crushed, and they have. But, you know, now it's tempting to say, okay, if there's going to be a recession, you want to extend duration, you want to go with longer treasuries. And I do, that's the part I really kind of wrestle with the most, is am I being too too paranoid about this funding explosion? I don't think so, but I do think you're going to get some very powerful counter-trend rallies in treasuries, longer treasuries. So I do think, I mean, if you treat them as, you know, trading vehicles, which is not what you typically do with long-term treasuries at this stage of the cycle, but I just don't see how you can't say this is different. We've never seen this set of dynamics before where you've got the Fed selling, the Treasury selling enormous amounts, foreign central banks totally disinterested, the U.S. banking system already drowning in treasuries. I mean, it's just a very toxic combination.
I totally agree with that. I think that's a part of this that people aren't really thinking about. There are so many ways for this to go wrong and a very, very narrow set of ways that this can go right. And I think to your point, trying to trade duration assets in conditions like this, good luck to you. You may make some really good money, but there's a significantly higher chance that you're going to get ripped one way and perhaps both. So there are so many other things that you can trade in these conditions with a lot more confidence than the long duration bonds. You know, it just seems crazy to me.
To your point, that's a great point. And I didn't want to forget that. So I'm glad you brought that up, is that, you know, you can actually own Newmont Mining, which has been crushed for a variety of reasons, some, you know, company specific, they've shot themselves in the foot a bit, but it's got a 4% dividend yield. So if you want to get a 4% yield, you know, rather than buy a 10-year treasury, which pays barely over that, I think Newmont Gold, Newmont Mining is way more attractive at this point. Because if you do get to, if you and I are right, and I think we both believe that the only plausible endgame for the federal government, the US government, is to basically get back to QE, I don't know what QE6 maybe it would be at this point, restart their magical money machine. And by the way, I don't think Jay Powell will be there for that. This is one of my, so I've got a few renegade predictions. One is that we're going to see rising interest rates and rising oil prices and a recession. But I also think we're going to see Jay Powell resign before he just won't go along with another QE. And I think he will then pass the baton to a more politically pliant individual. And that at that point, they will get back to doing QE. I just don't see how they avoid it. Now, they'll try to delay it. They'll try all kinds of other tricks before they get there. And if we're right about that, and maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, you can correct me if you disagree with that. But if that is the ultimate outcome, I don't see how gold doesn't just go absolutely ballistic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised it hasn't done that already. As anybody listening to me will probably know by now. Let me dig into that comment about Jay Powell, because I find that really interesting. The impetus for QE has always and consistently come from within the Federal Reserve. So I'm curious as to why you think he might resign rather than go along with it. Where is the call going to come from for QE? Is it going to become a political issue rather than a central banking issue? And if so, how does that transmission mechanism work?
Yes, I think there's going to be tremendous pressure from, say, Congress and maybe even within the Fed itself to monetize. And I do have to give Jay Powell credit. And you know, my book, Bubble 3.0, which actually was published in very early 2022, I was very critical of Jay Powell. And I think deservedly so. I think when he publishes his memoirs, he's probably admit that one of his greatest mistakes was to assume that inflation was transitory in 2021. But I have to give him credit that, you know, I would have assumed under the kind of severe market stress that we saw last year, which was the worst year for balanced portfolios since 1871. So he got killed in stocks, he got killed in bonds, at least longer term bonds. You would have thought that the old Jay Powell would have, you know, folded like cheap lawn furniture and gotten back into his, you know, easy money mode, the big easy, but he didn't. He stuck to his guns. He's continued to stick to his guns and found out that, unlike 2018, that if he did, that the world wouldn't shake apart. So you got to give him credit, but I think he's much more concerned about his legacy at this point than he is about being, you know, politically popular. But there's sure a whole lot of people at the Fed that want to be politically popular. And I do think that's one of the reasons why we are in a structural inflationary period, is the politicization of the Fed that's gone on. And he's at this point kind of the lone opposer of that trend. But that's why I think he's not long for this world. But I think it'll be his choice. I don't think he'll be forced out. But I could be wrong about that. That's a really extreme prediction. But I think it's a different Jay Powell than we've had up until this time.
Well, I hope so. But let's stick with that for a minute, because there is growing realization, I think, amongst people that the Fed, and by extension the other central banks who are being dragged around by the nose by Fed policy, are actually serious about killing inflation. It seems to be much more commonly believed now that they are willing to push the country into recession. They are serious about getting a handle on inflation, and they realize the dangers of letting it get out of hand. And I've been kind of kicking this around a lot myself in trying to understand how they react when they reach that point where the calls come in to go back to QE, the recession happens, and all the signs there that they need to cut interest rates. Obviously, we just haven't had this problem on the other side. We haven't had inflation holding their feet to the fire at any point during the QE experiment. There's never been if you do A, then you have to watch out for B. And this time, it's there. It's a very, very real problem for them. And I have to say, I feel like they're serious about it. I feel like they understand how dangerous it would be to let inflation really get a hand. And the wage data coming out in recent months is symptomatic of the beginnings of a wage price spiral, and that would be an absolute nightmare for the Federal Reserve. So how do you think that when they reach that critical moment, how does their reaction play out, do you think?
Well, first of all, I think you're exactly right. I think that that's one of the reasons why we are in structural inflation is we are starting to get this, you know, wage price spiral underway. I mean, you look at the UPS contract settlement, the American Airlines pilot settlement. I think this UAW one coming up could be a real shocker to the complacent consensus that's just sure that we're in this Goldilocks type of environment where the economy is not too hot, not too cold. And yeah, it's a major issue. And I do think they are very concerned about that, because then the inflation expectations get embedded. And once they get embedded, they're really tough to break. And I've actually been over the last year, I mean, I was very much in the camp that we were going to get a lot of inflation because of the response to COVID. But then about a year ago, and this when commodity prices fell out of bed, it was pretty obvious we're going to get easing inflationary pressures. But now commodity prices are starting to go the other way, particularly oil. I think oil is going to be in triple digits at some point before too long. And of course, that just percolates throughout the whole economy. But the other, I mean, you look at these consumer-facing companies like Pepsi. Pepsi raised prices 15% in June. And most of these guys like Procter & Gamble and ConAgra, I mean, they're raising in the 8 to 12%. I mean, these are big price increases for a time when inflation is supposedly cooling. And I do certainly understand that owner's equivalent rent's going to be, you know, a calming factor on inflation coming up soon. But there's a lot of other ones that are going the other way. And you know, like I've mentioned, these insurance rates are just shocking at how much they're going up. And people's property taxes are going up because of a, you know, lagged response to the housing price explosion that we had post-COVID. And I can't reiterate enough how inflationary I think this great green energy transition is, you know, what I call greenflation. That's not going away. So it reminds me so much of the 1970s where we did get some temporary, and I'm old enough, unfortunately, to remember them, where we did get some temporary inflation relief. And the Fed, you know, thought, oh, you know, now we can start cutting rates. And then, of course, it came roaring back because there were these underlying inflationary forcings, which we have once again. So I think the Fed is in a very difficult situation. But, you know, on the positive side, they do have a lot of room to cut rates. So obviously, when things go bad, the first thing they're going to do is try to cut interest rates a lot and see what that does. I think you could get a really rapid steepening of the yield curve where you actually have rising long rates and falling short rates, which in some ways is, some people will say, well, that's a good thing. Well, actually, it's not. I mean, that's really where you get into trouble, is when the inverted yield curve is like the warning siren going off. But when it uninverts is when you've really got problems. So that's the when the Fed starts to cut.
This inflation pulse, I'd like to stick on that for a minute, because obviously there's been a lot of commentary as the numbers, the CPI numbers month to month and year to year have fallen in recent months. You can see they've sent someone down to the storage unit to drag out the mission accomplished banner and kind of dust it off, getting ready to hang it. But I just look at this and it feels like the comps are going to get so much harder going forward. And to your point, we're starting to see these wages feed through. How likely do you think is a kind of second pulse of inflation that potentially is going to really change the way the public think about inflation? And as you said, that once those expectations get embedded, that's where the real problem lies.
Right. I think that's quite likely. I've been writing about a second wave of inflation coming. I don't think it's going to be nearly as intense as it was, you know, in 2021 and the first half of 2022. But I think any kind of a material pickup in inflation, given how, you know, kind of don't worry, be happy the most market participants are right now, it's going to be very uncomfortable. So I think it has, even if we get back up to a, you know, more like 4 to 5% you know, trending up rather than forward trending down, I think that's going to be disturbing.
We touched on energy prices earlier on. So let's focus on that now, because it's a space that you know really, really well. It's a space you've been investing in for some considerable amount of time. You talked about triple-digit oil price again. Prices up 20% in the last 3 or 4 months. We've seen gas prices up, petrol prices are up, diesel prices are up. Give us a little kind of overview of the energy sector, what the state of play is there and where you think the potential trades might lie.
I think it's once again a situation where people look at kind of the official statistics and they draw way too rosy a conclusion. And by that, I mean that the IEA, which is kind of the authority on where inventories, you know, supply-demand dynamics are, they tend to chronically, I mean, it's been going on for over 20 years, where they overestimate supply, underestimate demand, and then they have to make these massive adjustments. And this is one of my pet peeves, is these adjustments occur and it gets like no press, just like with the jobs numbers. So they tell the world that there's plenty of oil and say, you know, look at the inventories. And it doesn't look alarming if you look at just the official inventories. But of course, what the official inventories include are all these SPR releases. And that's over. And so I would argue that to have inventories just kind of normal at a time after you've had this, you know, tremendous dump of stockpiles into the marketplace should be concerning. And that you should really look at the inventory numbers adjusted for the SPR releases. If you do that, we're at like a 30-year low. And what's particularly shocking about that is when you look at how much demand has increased over the last 30 years. And the IEA keeps telling people, well, demand's going to flatten out because of the great green energy transition. But it's not. Demand continues to grow. And it's not because of the developed world. It's because of the developing world. For 15 years or so, we've seen declining demand in the developing world. I'm sorry, the developed world, but increasing demand in the emerging world. And that is likely to accelerate as those countries get wealthier. That's just an obvious correlation that the wealthier countries become, the more they spend on energy, the more they consume energy. And so you've got this situation where demand keeps going up and you've got very tight inventories making that critical adjustment. And I hear even energy experts get on, they don't even mention that. The other thing they don't mention is that these drilled but uncompleted wells are way, way down. So that's one way that the U.S. shales in particular have been able to maintain production, is by drawing down these wells that were drilled pre-COVID but weren't completed. You know, they just shut that process down when the price of oil went, at least the futures price went negative in April of 2020. So that is another thing that can't keep happening, just like the SPR releases can't keep happening. And yet demand just relentlessly goes higher. You know, people say, well, what happens when most of the new car sales are EVs? If you look at Norway, where 65% of EVs, 65% of new car sales are EVs, their oil consumption hasn't gone down. It's been basically flat for years. So I think there's a big fallacy about how quickly we're going to be able to move away from fossil fuels for, you know, a whole variety of reasons, but I'd say especially the emerging world. So it's I just think you can't, and you've got a major drop off in CapEx that's occurred over the last 5 years, actually even really 10 years. So there's been a tremendous underinvestment in the exploration for new oil and gas. And it was only because of the U.S. shales, which, by the way, like 90% of the world's production increase that's occurred in the last 10 years is because of the, you know, Permian Basin and the other prolific shale areas. And then, of course, the Marcellus. We basically, if you look at both oil and gas, we found almost 3 Saudi Arabias in the last 15 years. It's been an unbelievably lucky break for America and really for the world. Of course, we don't appreciate it. We've tended to demonize those guys, which is really unfair and unfortunate.
Yeah, but one of the solutions to this that's been mooted, and I say solutions with air quotes around it, has been changing the inflation target, right? Which it was inevitable that people were going to float this as an idea. If you can't hit your target, why not change it and then hit that? It's the same idea as, you know, lowering estimates and beating them by a penny. But what do you think the ramifications would be if they were to say, we're going to change the inflation target to 3% versus 2%?
Well, I think you get a step function increase in longer-term interest rates, you know, just as soon as that happens. And I think the Fed's aware of that. So they're going to do everything not to do there. You know, they are getting a lot of it. Wasn't it Jason Furman just this week in the Wall Street Journal that was advocating doing that? And the Fed is violently pushing back, at least the Jay Powell Fed. I think what will ultimately happen is that they will covertly agree to do that, but they won't admit it, because it would have such negative implications. And I think they'll continue to try to play with the numbers as they've often done to make it look like inflation is lower than it really is. I think another way that they'll try to solve this problem of, you know, potential fiscal dominance, which means that the Fed really has no choice but to step up and be the buyer of last resort, maybe even the buyer of first resort of all this government debt. You know, that's really what fiscal dominance is all about. But I think before they do that, they'll try to get the banks to do their dirty work for them. And another area where you're seeing some vectoring going on is towards increased reserves for the banks, where they have to hold an extra 20% in reserve. And I think they'll probably be inclined to force them to hold that in non-interest bearing government debt of some type, or at least government debt. And, you know, I guess maybe the non-interest bearing part might be a little tricky right now when you've got short-term rates as high as they are.
Well, you mentioned government debt, and that kind of brings us neatly onto credit markets. And again, there are so many different directions the information flow is moving in. You know, the spreads are still relatively tight, surprisingly so, I think, in many. And yet we are seeing deterioration under the surface. We've seen an extraordinary number of bankruptcies in the US, I think the highest since 2010, I think, or 2009 maybe. We're seeing, you know, a significant amount of this debt needing to reset, which is going to be much higher rates. We're seeing, someone told me this week that there were 15% of listed companies globally were zombie companies, now up from 5% 10 years ago. What do you think of the credit markets? What's likely to happen there? Because, we're in a position where it just doesn't work anymore. You cannot roll the debt over at higher rates. If you do, you are going to see this bankruptcy ledger get much, much bigger. And yet, if you try and do the inverse and you try and reduce borrowing costs, it feeds into that inflation narrative again. So what's your assessment of the credit markets right now?
Well, I fear your bewilderment. I think it is really surprising to see credit spreads where they are, given, you know, some of these factoids that you've cited, you know, like the fact that the bankruptcies, corporate bankruptcies are spiking. So it is odd, but it's a reality. And I think it is a little bit of a tale of two markets. I think there's going to be, you know, probably a great opportunity for those of us that actually do credit research, because certain companies actually benefit from these higher rates because they've turned out their debt, or they have very little debt. They've got big cash balances. And just like there's certain consumers that this is really good. You know, people that have a lot of cash and don't have a lot of debt, this higher interest rate environment is wonderful. But, you know, I think the problem is for the markets and the economy that the direction, either upward or downward, happens at the margin. So it's the marginal company, the marginal consumer, as they start to crack, then it starts to, you know, snowball. And to your point, if you look at credit card delinquencies, they've gone up. It's like the seriously delinquent credit cards have almost doubled over the last year. You're seeing the same thing with auto loans. I think the auto, you know, seriously delinquent auto loans are at the highest level since the Great Recession as well. So there is clear stress emerging, but you really haven't seen much of it. I think one thing that's a definite divergence is between the public and private markets. So in the private credit markets, you know, the loan markets, the interest rates are very high. I mean, you're talking about double digits, 12%. So there has been significant spread widening in the private credit market, not so much in the public credit market. And it's actually the same thing with the private equity, that these guys are getting great deals because there's a lot of distressed people out there, a lot of distressed companies that need to raise capital, and they can only do it at usurious rates. And so it's, I guess it kind of gets back to this lag thing, and maybe it's that these private markets are reflecting more accurately, more rapidly, the tightening of the screws. And I think ultimately to get to the public markets.
But the flip side of that private equity situation is you're seeing very few sales being made by the private equity companies. You know, they're obviously carrying them at certain values on their books. And one would imagine that in this environment, it's very difficult to get those kind of valuations. And it definitely feels as though there's an awful lot of deals being either pulled or not placed up on the auction block right now for fear of them revealing much lower valuations to me.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I think there's a lot of creative accounting going on right now. But I do think that it's true. It's a fact of the current condition that there is a big dichotomy between the valuations in public and private markets. And it's not always that way. Sometimes the public markets are at a big discount to the private markets, but that's certainly not the case right now. So I think really the big, you know, trillion-dollar, multi-trillion-dollar bet is, you know, which one converges, which way do they converge? Is it the public you know, basically falls in, you know, in price and rises in yield to the private, or vice versa. And I think it's going to be the former. I think the public markets have a serious shakeout coming their way.
Well, let's talk about that then. Given that as a backdrop, and it's a phenomenal assessment of the whole situation you've given us, what are the places to be investing? What are the places to be avoiding in the situation you just laid out?
Yeah, I think that there are some amazingly mispriced securities. And I guess that's just kind of riffing off what we were just talking about. But I look at the home builders, for example, and basically at all-time highs. And I know that builders have been adapting very well to this hostile environment, but they've been doing it by cutting prices. And they're taking the margin hits to do that. And you look at so that's for new homes. You look at existing homes, and that market's just frozen. And inventories are building, and I think they're going to continue to build because the sellers are unwilling to mark their homes down. And the buyers are dealing with one of the worst affordability scenarios we've ever seen. So something's got to give. And I think what's ultimately going to give is pricing. And once those prices come down for existing homes, that's going to put even more downward pressure on new homes. So I think that's not a great place to be right now. I'm talking my book or my personal book because I'm short the home builder ETF, but I really think it's kind of silly. I know Warren Buffett's going in there. So, maybe he's right and I'm wrong, but I just don't think it's a great risk reward situation right now. And, the long-term treasuries, I do admit that if we're right about the recession, I think there will be a time here where treasuries rally hard. But as you said earlier, that's a very tricky game to try to time that right. Well, then on that topic, and something that's important that I meant to mention earlier, is if you look at the future short position right now on long treasuries, it's very high. And a lot of people have pointed to that as a bullish factor for the treasury market. I'm usually a big believer in that. But what is interesting is if you look at the cash buyers of treasuries, they've actually got very long duration. And one theory I've heard, which makes some sense, is the reason you see such a large short position in the futures market is to hedge these massive cash, long cash positions. So I think that's why I would still say that with the treasuries, we're in a bear market. And I think the big rallies there, when they do occur, are to be sold. So I would be, kind of just long-term negative on long-term treasuries. I don't think this is the time to go long bonds. But I think commodities in general look very attractive. It goes back to your great friend, Tony Deaton. I've used this many times. It was a great line that you want to invest in scarcity. And these commodities are getting, at the same time, just like with oil, the demand goes up for copper, the demand goes up for lithium. Some of these lithium stocks have really pulled back hard and look quite interesting. And you just can't try to build a new mine. It's very, very difficult to build a new mine. So I think investing in those where there's been CapEx starvation for years is a lot better than with treasuries where they can just create those things at will by the trillions. It's amazing to me. I mean, to be able to, like we said earlier, would you rather have Newmont at 4% yield or the Treasury at a 4% yield? And I just don't think there's any question about it. I would have said uranium because uranium has been one of my strong picks here up until recently, but it's had a nice pop. So I'm a little hesitant to chase it here. But I do think that uranium has a tremendously positive future because, once again, I think most people are not paying attention to this nuclear renaissance that's going on because mostly it's happening outside of the U.S. There are 60 new nuclear facilities under development around the world, none of them in the U.S. The U.S., I do think, is going to go small, like small modular reactors. There's actually money being allocated out of the Inflation Reduction Act towards small modular reactors, but it's frankly chump change. But at least they're not fighting it anymore. So I do think uranium on weakness is one of the better ways to position. I think energy on weakness, again, you pointed out, it's had a big run lately, so I'd be a little bit careful right now. But I'd really be avoiding these, like the profitless tech companies that had such a monster recovery, and some of these meme stocks like Carvana to me looks insane. But it's a tricky area, as you know. The Reddit crowd, the Robinhood, they can drive them up, especially when they find a stock with a big short position. But again, I think just if you're an investor, think about what's scarce and what is going to be increasingly scarce going forward. And that's really where you want to focus most of your investment dollars.
Well, it just changes the equation significantly, right? To be able to get 5%, 6% of bank deposits and to play the short end of the treasury curve and get really decent returns in terms of giving you income with which to look elsewhere in places like commodities, which I agree. I think if you look at the historical valuation of commodities, I don't remember them being this low for most of my investment lifetime. But there are other places as well. Japan is something that I've been looking at recently. You know, the Japanese stock market seems cheap. It's finally back at all-time highs after 40-odd years. And the yen, you know, the moves we've seen in the 10-year JGB recently and the wavering commitment that the Bank of Japan has to that yield curve control, the pegging of the 10-year yield, tells me there's an awful lot going on in Japan that means it really ought to be, given the size of the economy and its importance to the global marketplace, it should be a place people are focusing.
I totally agree. And if you look in yen terms, the Nikkei has had a very impressive multi-decade breakout. So couldn't agree with you more. And actually, you brought up the yen, and a lot of people worry that if the yen has a big rally, that that's going to hurt the Japanese stock market. And that's true, but you can hedge that by going long the yen. And there are ways to do that pretty easily for U.S. investors involving ETFs. So that's actually, I'm glad you brought that up. That's one of my favorite vehicles. The other thing, I think, getting back to income, that if you were to do a barbell between the, you know, say a 5.5% short-term treasury and emerging market debt, I think emerging market debt in local currency in the stronger countries is actually very attractive. And once again, I think most Americans are pretty clueless to how a number of these countries have used, have employed much more rational and responsible fiscal and monetary policies. And you look at a country like Brazil, where they got their policy rate, the equivalent of the Fed funds rate here, up to 13-14%. Inflation's now in the 4-5% range. So you've almost got a Paul Volcker kind of situation with real bond yields. And so I think that that's one of the best ways to position a portfolio, because at some point, interest rates are going to start falling globally, and they actually are in some of these emerging countries. So if instead of doing the old playbook of using longer-term treasuries, I think use for your long-term money, skew that more towards the emerging markets, capture those, in many cases, double-digit yields. And once again, there's a number of, well, they're not ETFs, they're closed-end funds where you can even get a discount from net asset value. And so I think you're likely to get both appreciation and a great yield. There are definitely opportunities out there. And the other thing, too, I don't want to come across too negative. And actually, when I listen to some of the folks out there and on these various podcasts that I listen to on almost a daily basis, some of it is pretty dystopian. And I actually just got my copy of The Fourth Turning by Neil Howe. Have you read that book yet?
Yeah. The Fourth Turning is here. Fantastic. I mean, I think it's a brilliant read, as was the initial book.
So what got really captured my attention, because I was reading excerpts about it, and that's what caused me to order the book, is his, you know, he believes, of course, that we're going to emerge from this. So he sees a major crisis coming. I think he's exactly right. I think we've identified what that major crisis is going to be, which is this, you know, just absolutely unworkable federal fiscal situation. But I think there's a way out. And he actually said something which I've been writing about for years as a solution, which is an effective estate tax. Because if you think about it, the U.S. is in an unbelievably enviable position in some ways. We've got these bunch of old people like me and the boomers, and there's even some of our parents that are still alive, but there's going to be this massive wealth transfer between generations. And it's just a crime that the U.S. raises so little money from estate taxes. It's like $18 billion a year. I mean, that's just an hour or two of spending for the federal government. So but there's going to be tens of trillions of dollars transferred between generations here over the next, you know, 10 to 15 years. I think an effective estate tax, flat rate with virtually no loopholes or deduction, limit these charitable contributions so Warren Buffett can't give away all his money to charity. The government needs that money. And I think that money has to be dedicated to a fiscal restoration fund. I mean, it has to have absolute guardrails around it so that the politicians don't spend that money. And if you did that, you could restore the U.S. to a kind of a workable, sustainable federal debt to GDP level. And I think that's coming. I think that's going to be one of the solutions. And it was encouraging to see somebody as bright as him and as historically grounded as Neil Howe to basically say that is going to be one of the solutions. Not going to be the only one. In fact, I thought about the conversation you and I had last fall where we were talking about, you know, having the U.S. dollar guaranteed by it, because the U.S. government's got these enormous assets. You say, well, you really can't do that because that's not exchangeable. And it's a good point. I think that is true. But you could certainly have a two-tiered dollar where you have at least the dollar that is used internationally is backed by gold or gold and silver. So it is, you know, convertible on that basis. And that's actually how it used to be. I mean, the people talk about we got taken off the gold standard in 1971. Well, it wasn't U.S. investors that had the ability to convert to gold. It was only overseas. So I think that two-tier dollar is probably coming. But I do think we're the tremendous assets that the U.S. government has that are not as fungible, like, let's say, the real estate and, you know, all the oil and gas royalty rights they have. And that could go into basically like a first mortgage bond type of situation for treasuries, because I do think these fiat treasuries, as our friend Simon Mikhailovich calls them, candy wrappers, I think they're going to be a tough sell here pretty soon. But if they had first mortgage status, so that they actually had backing with real assets, and maybe that's what we're going to see is, again, a two-tier market develop where those bonds trade at much lower yields than the ones that don't have that kind of backing. So I think there's going to have to be some very creative solutions, but I do think the solutions exist, and I don't think we need to get into a nihilistic frame of mind, especially with all the wealth this country has.
No, look, that makes sense, but I think we are entering a period where real backing of things is going to become more and more important. People are going to issue the fiat no-backed solutions, and they're going to be much keener to invest in things that actually have a real backing. But it comes down to this problem you identified in the inheritance tax scenario, is how do you stop politicians spending that money? How do you create a way that doesn't just replenish their coffers and re-up their ability to promise and spend? I just don't think you can tame that instinct.
Well, it is a challenge, you know, when you're expecting the wolves to actually, police themselves or to restrain themselves when they, you know, can get the chicken coop. But something like that has to be done. We've just got to have, really strict legislation around that. Switzerland's been able to do that with their, limitation of debt spent. Basically, they limit their deficit increases to GDP. So it can be done. Whether it can be done in this country is a question. I mean, our political parties are obviously incredibly dysfunctional. And as you may know, I'm a supporter of no labels, which, I brought that up a year ago, nobody knew who they were. Now, all of a sudden, they really are getting significant political clout. I really do think we need a complete political house cleaning. And it would be great to see a really viable other way emerge, which I think no labels can be. And that was an organization originally started by Howard Marks, who's very famous in our business from Oak Tree. But it's a scary thing. I actually think that the rating agencies could play a role in this. I think when it comes to S&P and Fitch and Moody's, I almost think they need two credit ratings for sovereign debt. One that's based upon repayment in real dollars and one that's based on repayment in nominal dollars. And if you think about the U.S., we really should be AAA, unquestionable AAA rating based on nominal dollars. But being repaid in real dollars, we probably should be single B, maybe triple C.
Right, right. Yeah, no, it's an interesting concept. I need to think about that some more. I haven't really given it any thought. But listen, Dave, before we close, I have to ask you about this because it's day one of the BRICS conference as we're talking about this. And the future of the dollar is such a hot topic at the moment. Everyone's got to take, everyone's very dogmatic about what they think is going to happen, and there's no gray in the middle. Everyone thinks either the dollar's finished tomorrow or it's going to go on forever. What's your take on it, both as a reserve currency and as a reserve asset?
Well, as you were kind of alluding, I think the extreme views are inappropriate and likely to be inaccurate. I think the dollar is clearly losing market share, I mean, to put it in very simple terms. And I think that will continue to happen for a variety of reasons. But I don't think it's going to go away overnight. I think it will continue to play a very important role. And I do think we have the ability, if really push comes to shove, to say, okay, international folks, here's your new dollar. And you can convert it into gold and silver, but of course, at a much higher price for gold and silver than where it is currently, which of course is the ultimate bull story on the precious metals. But I don't think the US dollar's reserve status is in immediate peril. I think it's in long-term peril, kind of long-term slow, and maybe it's one day we'll wake up and it'll be like that old Hemingway quote of, or maybe it's Oscar Wilde, how did you go bankrupt? Well, at first very slow, very quickly, and that's, but right now we are, there's just no question that the U.S. government is broke, and it's broke even without bringing the entitlements on. Once you bring the entitlements on, it's just no way out without inflation, and that's, or something, like I've proposed, which is very radical and very unlikely to be endorsed anytime soon by politicians. But I do take encouragement, like Vivek Ramaswamy, who came out of the blue. He's kind of like no labels. He was completely off the radar. And I don't think he's going to win the nomination, but he's at least bringing, you know, young, new, you know, thinking to the political realm that so desperately needs it. So, and that's kind of the old Howe thing too, right? It's going to be that generation with some guidance from the old folks like us, you know, where we empower them and say, yes, you know, we need to sacrifice. Our generation, the boomers have had it too good. And, you know, who owns the bonds? Mostly it's the boomers. And I really believe bondholders are going to be the sacrificial lambs of this terrible fiscal situation we've gotten ourselves in. So I'm hopeful. I just think we have a really tough decade ahead of us, but I think the 2030 is going to be great. I can live that.
If we can get there, yeah, if we can get there. Well, listen, mate, before we wrap up, just talk a little bit about the Haymaker and what you're doing with it, because it's been a fantastic thing to read over the course of the last, what, 18 months or so that you've been writing it. Talk a little bit about your future plans for the Haymaker.
Well, you're very kind to say that. And as you know, and as a lot of our readers know, we've gone paid here recently, which is a kind of a scary thing, although we do still put out a lot of free content. So on Mondays, we do our Making Hay Monday that has the two charts of the week, and it's got about the first half of the main body of text available. But we have gone behind the paywall, which, as I said, it's a little bit of a terrifying time, but we have a very reasonable tier. I know you've got a similar type of structure. And that, you know, I think is a, you know, a bargain. But even on our higher level, we really want to spoil those people, call them the founding members. And in terms of doing a monthly podcast where it's, you know, they're able to ask questions to me and I can be a little bit more open about some of the recommendations. And we do on Friday, the Haymaker, which we actually have, you know, fairly specific trading recommendations. Now, we don't name names because that's from a compliance standpoint. The SEC doesn't like that and they're really cracking down. And it amazes me that some of my competitors do that on CNBC all the time. But anyway, I think that's going to change over time. So the point is we give quite a bit of guidance and more, you know, kind of actionable specific recommendations than most of our competitors do. And we do have a big focus on income generating ideas, which has always been, you know, our strength. I mean, that's where our performance numbers have been, you know, really strong over the years is in the income world. So I think it's valuable, but only time will tell. I mean, it's really going to be the market that votes. And I may be telling you in 6 months that I'm going to go play a lot more golf.
I doubt that very much. You know, watching the transformation from, you know, EVA to the Haymaker over the last 5 years, it's been fascinating to watch. You've done such a great job with it. And it's always something I look forward to reading. So, you know, congratulations on that. And for anybody listening to this that hasn't checked it out, let them know how they can find out more about it and where they can read it, more importantly.
Haymaker at Substack or Haymaker _ at Substack, but really just Haymaker Substack, you'll get there. It's pretty easy. And yes, please do that. We'd be very grateful to have you at least just check out our stuff. And Grant, you're always such a great host. And how long have we been doing this? How many years? What was the first one? Like 6 years ago?
Yeah, mate, that was 2018. That's right. We came and sat there with you and you ended up giving me a fantastic conversation. So I'm still grateful to you for that for 5 years later. Listen, my friend, it's always a pleasure to see you and to get a chance to chat with you. Hopefully we can do it in person in the not too distant future. Talk of you maybe visiting the Low Country and we can get together and discuss this over a round of very poor quality golf. What do you think?
Well, I'm sure I'll be the one with the poor quality golf. As you know, I have just tremendous admiration for your ability to hit it 300 yards off the tee.
You're right.
The only way I can do that is when I hit a cart path or a sprinkler head.
All right. Well, let's try and make that happen. It'd be good to see you. But in the meantime, again, Dave, thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Grant. Be talking to you soon.
Well, as I said at the top of the show, it's always just such a pleasure talking to Dave, and this time was no different. Once again, please do check out haymaker.substack.com to read more of Dave's superb work. I have a very strong feeling that what comes next for all of us is exactly the kind of environment in which the Dave Hayes of this world will be able to use their vast experience to thrive. That's it from me. I'll be back with another podcast soon. In the meantime, thank you all so much for listening.
Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.